happening now. We'd like to welcome our viewers from across North America and around the world. This is the EdTech Situation Room, episode 321 for March the 6th, 2024. My name is Wes Fryer, and I'm coming to you from Charlotte, North Carolina, where I am a middle school media literacy and STEM teacher on spring break. Basically, we have our statewide ed tech conference, the NC Ties conference that starts tomorrow in Raleigh. And so, I have the opportunity, thanks to my school, to be able to go to that. And spring break is next week. So life is good. But joining me as always, Dr. Neifer, he is dedicating himself to, I think, a rigorous regimen of athletic training in this new facility that he has constructed in his basement, which you can all see in the background. Dr. Neifer, how is that going? And did you get 10 feet of snow like the High Sierras, just a little bit, you know, maybe southwest of you?
Well, everything's going well. Sadly, we did not get that much snow, which we could have used, to be real frank about the situation. We're well below historically low snowpacks in Montana, which should lead to an interesting spring and potentially a fired up summer, and not in the good way. So we're keeping a close eye on it. But I'm the executive director of the Montana Digital Academy, which is the Montana State's virtual school located in the beautiful University of Montana campus located in western Missoula, in the beautiful town of Missoula. And tonight, what are we doing here, Wes? Like, why have we pulled in the attention of the nation tonight to talk about technology?
Well, Jason, we have been gathering for, I don't know, what, 5 years periodically on Wednesdays to talk about the news and to shoot it through an educational prism. So we have gathered a variety of links related to technology and education. And that is, those links are found on a Google Doc that you can connect to by going to edtechsr.com/links. As we talk about those said links, we will drop them into our chat stream, in which we're going to both Facebook and YouTube live. And I think we've got a couple live viewers. So we want to say hello to everyone and invite you, if you want to just share who you are, where you are. It's always interesting to learn where folks are coming to us from. And if you've got any questions, and you know, basically Jason and I don't get to debate anymore because, you know, we're too old. But this gives us an opportunity to, you know, do some rants from time to time. And honestly, it really gives each of us an opportunity, I think, certainly does for me, to deepen my own understanding of these issues and really wrestle with them, trying to identify, you know, what things are relevant in different educational contexts and sort of where are things headed. Because, you know, we have a wide variety of links, and we're certainly going to talk about AI a lot, but this is a big part of my personal learning journey that I appreciate. Yeah. So.
Yep. And I would say exactly the same. And one of the things that I've said a couple of times in the last couple of weeks, as there's been an interesting phenomenon in regards to these developments of AI, is that I really do believe the conversation is step one of really figuring out policies and procedures regarding this. And I think part of it is that it's so new and it's moving so quickly that anyone that tells you they have the recipe for success here, I think, is either trying to tell you something or maybe he's not thinking it all the way through. And we'll see where things go, but I really do think it's a unique opportunity to engage other learning professionals as we talk about what's valuable to us. And this, for me, is a part of that conversation that's helping me figure out where I stand on all these incredibly complex and interesting issues.
Absolutely. Where would you like to begin tonight, sir?
Well, let's maybe stay away from AI for a couple minutes, because there's plenty to talk about that's not AI. Let's do some security and privacy news. I want to talk about, last week, Biden signed an executive order, this is according to Engadget, on February 28th, that aims to stop Russia and China from buying Americans' personal data. As we talked about several times, in the past, that, a lot of people's personal data is for sale, and not in the dark web or anything along those lines, but just in the straight up marketplace, because our personal information is a currency. And whether we like it or not, you know, our engagement, not just with the internet, although the internet is the primary, culprit here, but really if we engage in any commerce with a trackable means, so you're ordering via a catalog on a credit card, or, you are driving to a grocery store, every Tuesday, there's a good chance that that information will be tracked somewhere and ultimately sold, not necessarily to the highest bidder, but certainly to someone that may or may not have your same interest in mind. And what I think is really interesting about this is I think it's good that we're trying to regulate the sale of data in this way, except that in general, the multi-gazillion dollar businesses that are selling this data, kind of the data broker industry, we really should be regulating them much more broadly. And what I think is so interesting about this is that this is a kind of a chicken way of starting this conversation, right? It's easy to point our fingers at Russia and China, Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, Cuba are also targeted by this executive order. But the bottom line is that we are in an era where all of our data, it can be bought and sold. And I've seen a couple articles that suggest this, but you know, if you spend enough time looking at the marketplace, you can usually get data about specific people. It's not just data in aggregate. A lot of very personal data is for sale by what are considered to be otherwise legitimate brokers. And so I kind of want to point out, to my mind, the hypocrisy of this, that I agree we should be banning the sale of data to nefarious actors, but I also consider a lot of people that are legitimately buying that data to also be nefarious actors as well. And you're on mute, sir.
There we go. Well, thank you, sir. Little flashback to COVID, everyone. COVID Zoom. I have a sad, very current story to share about this. And of course, as I speak these words, I'm very cognizant of the fact that my words are being transcribed on YouTube and Facebook. And, you know, that's why I'm not going to say my email address and my phone number out loud right now. But my wife and I have been considering refinancing our house. And so we went ahead and went to our current lender and filled out an application. Guess what has been happening to us the last 2 days? Both of our phones have absolutely exploded with direct text messages to both of our phone cell phone numbers and to phone calls. I mean, I have 71 missed calls on my phone today. 71. And it is horrible. And I talked to the guy who, is the agent that we're working with our current lender, who we're very happy with and I think is very legitimate. And I'm a veteran. I have a VA loan. Not that that means anything because these loans get sold to all kinds of companies. But I said, you know, just to let you know, we've kind of had a bit of a nightmare with this. And can we call Experian? Or because some of them have said where they got the information. He said, oh, no one's really complained about that or said anything about that before. I don't really know. Maybe you could. And I'm like, it's crazy. So something must have changed. I mean, it's been almost 2 years since we purchased our home. If it's just refinance that triggers that, but that is just crazy. And I mean, this isn't the end of the world. Thankfully, Apple in iOS has the silence unknown callers. And so, you know, I'm teaching my class and maybe I didn't set it for this year, but I had actually set the focus zones so that when I'm in class, my phone goes on to do not disturb. So anyway, it's just a personal story to this, but I'm 100% with you. It's not just about China and Iran and, you know, Russia and whoever else you want to, like North Korea. This is about the information that is for sale for anyone who wants to pay. And we do not have a comprehensive privacy law in the United States. We need one. And I will report back to the podcast as far as what I find out, because I am going to contact, you know, the major credit bureaus. And
I would think that we probably should be able to limit it. The guy said, well, they have your cell phone on file. So because I told him, look, I would have given you my Google Voice number and a different number if I knew this was going to be, you know, released to literally, I think, hundreds, if not thousands of credit brokers. But isn't that crazy to be like you take this act and then it's a real personal thing to be texted directly and have that kind of interruption? It somehow feels more offensive to me today than just spam, because you know we've got thousands of spams. So yes, we need it. So besides EFF, are there any other organizations that you can think of offhand that are good for people to support, and you know, or nonprofits, I guess, that are advocating for privacy rights specifically and legislation?
Not that I can think of, but I do think that now that you say that, I might do a little research and maybe make a couple of donations in honor of your experience, in part because I do think that it's just very frustrating, because I know for every consumer like you and Shelly and Allison and I that can navigate through this, imagine the confusion for someone that isn't as cynical perhaps as we are about what's happening. And more importantly, I think about in context of my elderly parents, right? Like my mom has always been, very curious about things. She is pretty good at spotting scams, and, there's only been maybe two or three instances in the last 20 years where, you know, she called me to talk through something and her spidey sense was right that something was wrong. But, you know, as the number of folks, in their retirement age increased dramatically, many of them are huge targets for scams. If they're engaged in legitimate business and are still and then have to deal with all this extra cruft, I feel like there just isn't enough protection for people, especially those that are vulnerable. And the bottom line is that I think your story is copied over and over again in tons of different kinds of transactions and engagements with commerce. And I think it's just really both sad and something we should be able to do something about.
Absolutely. And if anybody, you know, listening, either we've got a few live folks with us tonight, or anybody who's listening to this later has suggestions, you know, please reach out to us. We would love to. Hey, and we've got a viewer. Marta's right here from Tegucigalpa from Honduras. How awesome. Glad to have you with us. It's been a while.
And also Jason and Betsy Springer with us tonight as well. So great to see. I saw Betsy last week in Austin for the Digital Learning Annual Conference. Welcome to both of you tonight as well.
Absolutely. All right.
Let me do another article that's kind of related to that. This one is from Fast Company. I saw a YouTube video about this last week, and I saw this article and just want to talk about it for a moment. Walmart is buying a Vizio, which is a popular television brand. I think my first big flat screen was a Vizio, and I've had generally good luck with that brand name over time. And they have purchased Vizio for $2.3 billion in cash. And when I originally saw the headline about this, it seemed like a good move. It's a respected brand name. Walmart sells an awful lot of televisions. I know from several stories around this, but as the story I read into, watched on YouTube last week talked about, and this goes into some detail about this, Walmart's not really buying this for the hardware business. They're buying it for the users of Vizio platforms as an advertising platform. And that's really interesting to me because $2.3 billion, isn't what it used to be, is part of what I would say. So that seemed like actually a low amount of money in light of the fact that, I perceive this to be kind of a major brand in this area. But it appears that the advertising and services, division of Vizio, which pushes out advertisements over the television's platforms, are really what Walmart is really aiming at, because they would like to try to find new ways of both advertising themselves and gaining ad revenue. And so they're essentially buying eyeballs here, which I think is just incredibly fascinating. And, you know, if you don't believe that your data is valuable, I think this is a good example where it very much is. Now, obviously, you know, advertising specifically mentioned here, but even if it wasn't, the incredible metrics that I'm sure get generated from a smart television in 2024 are, you know, the Nielsen's absolute dream from, you know, the last 50 years, because the amount really interesting data that it can collect on you from just your television watching habits, let alone the apps that might be on a television, is probably worth an extraordinary amount of money. So very interesting development, and I think proof positive that advertising dollars matter.
We're going to have regulation to get these changes made, and I do not know, hopefully I will, live to see this change. But one of the things that occurs to me that we need is the ability to have a do-over with a phone number. And our phone system, and I, you know, I worked for AT&T in Oklahoma for 2 years. I was sorry, Marta. You click the wrong thing in chat and you've got it on the screen for 5 minutes. wasn't anything bad. So I worked for AT&T for 2 years. I was an education advocate. I got to learn a whole lot more about telecommunications and E-rate and all that stuff. We have a very, you know, antiquated system of allocating these phone numbers. And while like internet IP addresses, not to get too crazy geeky, you know, underwent an IP6 change to be able to vastly increase the numbers of available addresses. And that was important for the Internet of Things. We haven't, to my knowledge, I have not heard a mainstream media article saying, hey, we've got the new phone system of different numbers to propose. Because even if I go out and get a new cell number, I'm going to inherit whoever's, you know, whoever had that number before. And, you know, there are issues there. You know, SMS is not encrypted, et cetera. And companies like the status quo, you know, the world that we live in is like it is for different reasons. And not to just be a real cynical guy, but, you know, there are folks who have worked hard, lobbied hard, engineered hard to get things as they are today. So I think that is a very interesting article from Walmart. We have talked before about how smart TVs that have the built-in smart features are not our friends. And my recommendation is definitely to plug something into your television. And if it has any smart features, turn those off. Now, we all like things to be easy. So what do folks tend to do? Oh, look, I can, you know, stream Netflix just right off my TV. Let me just log in. But didn't you, you had an article about, was it TVs listening or was that actually phones listening? That was about a month ago or so with that.
It was TVs listening, I believe.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was TVs listening. It was some kind of group that was admitting that they were actually pulling, you know, audio off of these devices that they're putting in homes. So, just keep that in mind. And the last I had checked into this, it was almost impossible to buy a quote dumb TV that did not have the built-in guts of the smart technologies, because it's so lucrative for the companies to gather all that kind of data.
Yeah.
So we can keep. Well, do you want to say something else, and I'll follow up with
you? Yeah, I just want to say that you know, my way of dealing with this is probably not as clever as I think it is, and maybe also fraught with peril. But this is part of the reason why I moved exclusively to Apple stuff for my television. Right? That I feel like that. I'm almost certain that there is data being collected by Apple. I'm almost certain that they're using it. Although I do think that they have. They have done a pretty good job of building in protections for other companies trying to use my data through Apple devices, right? I feel like if I just stay in that one ecosystem, you know, it's just the one ecosystem, right? That I'm not also using a Roku, I'm not also using an Amazon Fire TV, although I like that platform quite a bit. The bottom line is that by sticking with the one, you know, one group is getting my data as opposed to many, but. You know, I still think that we are probably underestimating truly how much our data is worth. And the bottom line is that, you know, the reason why, you know, three of the richest people on earth are in technology, it's not because people like cool hardware. It's because people generate data.
Here at some point, Dr. Knifer and I will retire. I think it'll be a long time for me. But I think a very important topic. This is one of those things like we talk about so often, you know, just about every week, and it, you start to connect dots and things. I think that advocating long-term for privacy, not just privacy regulation, but privacy rights in the United States. And I'm not saying we should take GDPR from Europe and just say, hey, we're copying this. There are some huge, huge powers, to your point about richest folks in the world and biggest corporations, that want the system to stay as it is. And so it'll take quite a bit. I mean, it took a lot to get antitrust legislation in the United States, right? It was a huge populist movement and it was very controversial. But elements of that remain with us today, thankfully. So anyway, I think that for anybody listening, if you know besides EFF, and I did drop that link in, for those listening and not seeing the live video, EFF.org/issues/privacy. They're definitely doing some outstanding advocacy around that. And there've got to be other groups that are doing that and specifically coming up with some proposals. You know, we're so incapable of moving the needle with meaningful legislation today, because of culture wars and other things, that I think it will be a while before we might be able to move the needle with this, but I think we need to keep on. Oh, and great. Jason's got a question. GDPR. GDPR is the General Directive for Privacy Regulation. I will Google that with Wikipedia. It's the European
General Data Protection Regulation.
Okay, there you go.
Although, I mean, same intent.
General Data Protection Regulation. There you go. So, and like a lot of things, I'll go to Wikipedia and drop that in as a good launch pad spot. But this is the way that Europe has responded to a lot of this and many of the lawsuits and the court orders and penalties and things like that that we see being meted out against tech companies are, a result of GDPR. So thank you for asking, because as I tell my students, if you're wondering something, I know there's other people that are wondering it too. So let me follow up with another security article since we're in that headline. And this is Ars Technica from February 28th. $30 doorbell cameras can be easily hijacked, says Consumer Reports. It's been a little while since we've probably dove deep into the Internet of Things, but you know, we are a Google. We like Apple TVs in our family, but we're a pretty strong Google family when it comes to the Internet of Things, the Google Nest Wi-Fi and things like that. And it was probably when I first installed, and it was before it was Google Nest, maybe it was just Google Wi-Fi, that I was able to say, oh my gosh, look, there's 35, you know, Wi-Fi devices connected, you know, to our house. And so, the point of this article is that we need to be very, very careful when we purchase devices that connect to the internet. You need to think about the ecosystem, to Jason's point about, you know, Apple and him feeling very comfortable, primarily being in that more privacy oriented, ecosystem than some other alternatives. You know, even after the problems with these doorbells have been reported, these things are still very easy to access. So, it is not the case when it comes to digital devices that connect to the internet that any of us should just be shopping based on price. We really need to check out more. Ideally, you want these devices to update and to not just, you know, stay at their current firmware, because vulnerabilities are identified and there are lots of bad actors, both nation states and individuals and all kinds of organizations that are constantly at war against different groups and that they're, you know, compromising devices. So don't buy a $30 doorbell camera, folks. Look carefully at the model and do a little bit of research before you put something on your home, whether it's pointing outside or inside.
Excellent call. Well, Wes, here's what I like to do. I think I want to talk about new Apple stuff for a second, just because, you know, we're like that. And then I want to do the Microsoft article, and then that's a springboard to talking about AI.
Fantastic.
So let's start with this week. Apple released new editions of their MacBook Airs, a 13-inch and 15-inch MacBook Air with the M3 chip in it. And the form factor is the same. So we're talking about the same M2 MacBook Air form factor and the same 15-inch MacBook Air form factor. These laptops are delightful and really well thought out. I've just held one of the 15 inches in a store before, and it's a incredibly nice piece of hardware. It probably would be something if I didn't already own way too many digital devices that I probably would consider as a main laptop for home. And the 13-inch second generation model, which is the same form factor as the third generation model, is also a really nice laptop. But the reason why I think this is interesting is because I think this tells me that whatever is going to get released in the next month or two from Apple is probably going to be a lot bigger than this, because this seems like standard fodder for springtime releases. And so I've heard leak articles talking about how there's going to be dozens of new SKUs this year. So that means lots of new versions of laptops, potential changes to the hardware for iPads, maybe a larger iPad Air is the term I'm looking for. Lots of new interesting things happening, but it is exciting to see that the M3 chip is available, and I expect to see an M4 chip sometime later this year.
And we've talked about this on the show before. Apple oftentimes is later to the game when it comes to a particular technology. We have not heard much from Apple in terms of AI. Certainly Apple uses AI and is integrated into the software, being able to use speech to text. There's a lot of different ways, but we don't have sort of a ChatGPT, Claude, co-pilot type service from Apple. But we did report a couple of weeks ago, I think, about a patent that was related to AI, and I've read some articles, if we haven't shared them, where some folks are predicting that 2024 is going to be the year of AI for Apple. So it is going to be very interesting to see, because Apple's not, sitting back and saying this isn't a big deal. They certainly are going to be. How do they implement that? And I think that patent had to do with, instead of a graphics card doing that onboard processing, Apple was setting it up so that their silicone chips, particularly in the iPhone, but it'll also be in their portables and their desktops, are going to be able to do onboard processing and to follow along with the privacy focus. Instead of sending it to the cloud, to OpenAI or Microsoft or whatever, it's just going to be the large language model entirely downloaded on your device, running locally on your device. And there are open source tools that allow you to do that now, just like we have chatbots, but they can, create images and things like that. There's a host of issues with all that, but that's going to be super interesting to track. And I'm hoping, I don't know if this will be the case, but that they'll have some of the Vision Pro devices at the conference I'll be at in the next couple of days, because I'd love to strap one of those on and check it out. And I'm going to bet that Apple will probably have that, but I don't know that there's going to be many schools, paying that $3,500 price. It's going to have to come down quite a bit for both consumers as well as certainly schools, but even enterprise to broadly adopt. But I think I read, I don't have this article, that, Apple is in the process of courting developers, because Apple knows really well that if you don't have the apps and the software that goes with, you're not going to be a viable alternative platform. And I've seen several videos that have just really emphasized what a game changer this technology is. But it's going to have to get lighter, it's going to have to get less expensive, and we're going to have a lot more apps. And I would say that's probably what Apple is continuing to work on. But yay for updates on these devices. And I hope that my school, gets an M2 or an M3. I'm happy with my M1, but ready for something faster. That'll be fine.
Yeah. And speaking of that, I do think that they're one of the greatest things about the Apple world in general is the fact that I do think there's just a lot of really clever apps, particularly on Mac OS, that it's less so about like iPad. I feel like that ecosystem is as strong on Android as it is in Apple. But when it comes to desktop apps, for sure, it's no contest. And there's probably a half dozen, maybe even a dozen apps that I download every time I refresh a computer or get a new Mac OS device that I really just can't live without. They're so critical to my critical to my daily workflows, and that's one of the hard things. I have a lockdown PC at work, Mac at work that I unfortunately am not an administrator of anymore. I used to be administrator on campus, and now they've taken it away from some of us nerdier users because of liability insurance of all things. But the bottom line is that it is pretty sweet that we have the ability to do so many like nifty workflow tricks on these particular devices.
Okay. And you want to do something else as a segue to the AI stuff?
Yeah. So we're going to do two Microsoft articles here. So let me start with the one that's more about kind of Microsoft Windows. Windows 11, which is the operating system that is the current one that Microsoft is pushing for, Windows 10 is stop support in, I think it's the end of 2025, maybe. It's a year or two off still. And so Windows 11 is their new operating system. And I have installed Windows 11. And I'll talk about that in our next article in a moment on kind of my Windows, home Windows laptop. And one of the great features, or greatly touted features of Windows 11 was the ability to run Android apps. And so, much like you can run, iPad and iPhone apps on Mac OS, and also you can run Android apps on Chrome OS, you could run Android apps, through what was called the Windows subsystem for Android, on Windows 11. But the problem was, amongst other problems, was that the only app store available to them, because they weren't able to get Google to license the app store to them, was the Amazon app store, which we've talked about a little bit in the past. That one of the biggest problems with the Amazon universe is that unless you hack the Google Play Store onto an Amazon tablet, it is functionally worthless because the Amazon App Store is so terrible, does not feature very many apps, isn't really a full-featured marketplace, is missing almost all of the critical apps. And from the start, I've only downloaded it once, I signed into my Amazon App Store. I don't think I ever opened the app ever again because I had no reason to, because I couldn't get the apps that I needed. And so, you know, and I pretty regularly wipe Windows machines just out of, I guess, maybe fun or self-torture. But the bottom line is that I've never found the need to turn that back on again because there's no apps for me to do there. And this turns out, Microsoft announced this week that, Windows subsystem for Android is gone. And they didn't even give much warning. They'll still continue to support it for, I think it's another year for people that already have it downloaded. But as of the time of the announcement, you can no longer download it. So that tells you how much, that it was being used, because there probably would be some outrage if this was a beloved, part of the Microsoft ecosystem. It's no, Google RSS reader, for sure, right? But the bottom line is that it was yet another kind of Microsoft idea that fizzled.
Hmm. You're just very hygiene oriented when it comes to your Windows operating systems, I think. So
it's true. It's
yeah.
true.
Which yeah, is, there's right. good re- there's good reason to be as well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And they slow down over time, whether we like it or not.
It occurs to me, you know, I don't know that we have these articles in this week, but there's pretty big antitrust stuff going on in Europe against the app stores, you know, and specifically Apple, but this affects Google as well. And from what I've read, it's forcing multiple app stores to be able to run on Apple devices. We need to grab some articles to get those specific details. But, you know, this, as you said, is not a vibrant and wonderful, operating system or app store, sorry, alternative. But, you know, that's by design when it comes to Google as well as Apple. So yep. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens. You know, Apple is there saying this is bad because of security and we're not going to be able to vet these things. And so people are going to have more malware on their devices. That very well could be true, but it's also going to be interesting to see the creativity that, that companies are going to bring to bear when it's not a, you know, there's more than one game in town in terms of app stores. So, all right. Does that segue us to a little Microsoft AI?
It does. So this is an article from Paul Thurrott's website, Thurrott.com, and he noted something that I've also actually also experienced too, that Microsoft has released a major update for Windows 11. And one of the things they do in that update is more prominently feature Copilot, which is Microsoft's play in generative AI. Although I am interested to know that they are also starting to invest in some of the smaller AI models. Minstrel, which is a French AI model, apparently has received some Microsoft support as well. But I have my trusty use Lenovo X390. That is what I use to install Windows stuff onto. And this is going to be the lousiest demonstration ever because you can't really see it. But there used to be a button in the lower left-hand side that that took you to the Microsoft Copilot. It's now been integrated in the operating system on the right-hand side. They call it Copilot Preview. But you can see here probably a little bit that on the right-hand side of the screen, yeah, worst demo ever, there's a Copilot box there now, and I like it. I think that's a good place to stick that box. I would like to see more AI features generate or like directly in the operating system. I will say that so far, I do own a Chromebook Plus, so I should have more generative AI features from Google in that platform. And I haven't really seen that integrated as well as I would want to yet, but I'm really looking forward to somebody, whether it's Apple or Microsoft or Google, to really bake the AI into the operating system. Not that I think necessarily that's a good idea. I just want to try it, right? And I really, 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 really want to see what that looks like when I'm not having to go constantly back and forth to an AI model to do some of the work I do that's enhanced by AI. So interesting stuff to me. I do think Microsoft, for better or for worse, is all in on this stuff. So interesting to watch them play through these pieces.
Well, when they get really serious, they'll just bring back Clippy. And then, the hordes of folks are going to just immediately adopt. So.
Yeah, I've just been waiting for biding my time till Clippy makes its return into my life. So.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit, if we can, about this controversy that Google, I don't know what their stock price tumbled to, but this, the AI images that were controversial. Can we do that one next?
Yeah. So this was a big story a couple weeks ago, and we haven't had a chance to talk about it yet, but Google's chatbot is now called Gemini. Well, actually, I should say Google's chatbot Gemini now does image generation. And so that's
because they're doing multiple strategies, multiple.
Right. Yeah. And if anything, and Google also released another open source model last week, and they've had a lot going on there that's actually a little confusing. But, in this particular case, they were called out on social media because, as an example, quoting from the article from Nico Grant, a user said this week that he had asked Gemini to generate images of a German soldier in 1943. It initially refused, but then he added a misspelling, generate an image of a 1943 German soldier. It returns several images of color, people of color in German uniforms, a rarity in the German military at that time. And the AI-generated images were posted to X by the user, exchanged messages with the New York Times, but declined to give his full name. And if you look at the actual images, they're ridiculous on face, right? For a variety of reasons. But the bottom line is that it just seems like a really dim-witted way to try to deal with a lot of the very real issues with bias in these large language models. And it can't be the answer that on top of all the training data, and it says, oh, by the way, make the group diverse, and then that's the answer to the question, right? You know, obviously that power should be given to the end user, because if it's not spitting out what you're looking for, you know, you should be able to ask for what you want it for, but that's just, it's just silly on face. And so Google has taken the ability to generate images of people out of the Gemini model. You can still do the other generation for sure. But I also saw another article that said that Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Alphabet, was very, very terse with his staff over this and said it's just plainly not acceptable. And I think that hard to tell if this is negligence or just sloppiness on the part of Google. We'll never know inside what's looking like right now, but I think it just picks at so many extraordinary issues that AI is starting to jump in the middle of.
So number one, it reveals the importance of the algorithms and the guardrails and the biases, the alignment which the developers are attempting to put onto AI. Alignment means trying to get the outcomes and the, you know, it's anthropomorphic to say the ideas, but to get these large language models to align with a set of values. And so it is illustrative. It's instructive, you know, in terms of the programming that Google engineers are putting into their tool to make that diverse. Now, I will say that I think OpenAI is doing the same thing. It's interesting to me when I will visualize something. Sometimes I do Bible verses. I do a whole lot of different things. And when I'll ask for something like a photo of a group, and I'm not in that case specifically saying, and please make the group diverse, or please, you know, put African Americans in this. It defaults to that. So I think that's point number one. Point number two is these things are just going to happen. The groups that are developing these AI models are red teaming them and giving the beta, not yet for public release versions, to a variety of folks. And they're trying to say, hey, see if you can, if not break this, get this to do something that we wouldn't want it to do. You know, maybe we shouldn't let everybody just get the recipe for thermite. Maybe we shouldn't let people, you know, analyze federal buildings in the Midwest of the United States and figure out where to, you know, drop off a lot of fertilizer. There's really practical things that relate to, you know, terrorism and, you know, harming people physically or kinetically, as well as in the cyber world, right? Being able to create viruses and worms and things like that. So I think that this is just something that's going to happen. It's really a lot of egg on Google's face. But honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if those things couldn't happen to Claude or to ChatGPT. Maybe they have planned for those kinds of queries. I don't know if you've had this experience, Jason, but I have been increasingly frustrated at the refusal of ChatGPT as I'm paying for it to create especially different visualizations of things that I am like trying to not share polarizing media, but I've just, you know, I'm finishing up a 6-week course on teaching the conspiracies, and we've talked about contemporary conspiracy theories. And so it's just very, very clear to me that there are a large number of guardrails, and given, you know, lawsuits that are ongoing between the New York Times and OpenAI and other things, there's a lot of conservative things that have been, you know, affected the code base of these models. But that is probably one of the loudest outcries that we've seen. And it's also probably the media having a feeding frenzy. There's all kinds of folks that want to decry AI. And I'm seeing, you know, artist groups and people saying, don't ever use it. It's, you know, it violates ethics to use it at all. And I'm not really on that page, but it's been a feeding frenzy for the media to jump on this. And it decreased the value of Google's stock price by millions of dollars, I think. So.
Well, and the other thing about the media frenzy around this is that I feel like the coverage has been almost universally outside of tech media, and the tech media coverage has been just okay. But the mainstream media, broad news media, has done a terrible job covering generative AI. And I just see, I read an article last week that was from one of, I maybe it was Axios. I can't really remember. It was one of those kind of newer brands in online news. And, the article was about, you know, schools struggling to deal with AI. And, you know, this reporter, it seemed like that she was on an education beat, as it turns out, and, made some really broad claims that I just didn't think were vetted by the facts. Just, she said, you know, things like good teachers can tell when it's AI generated, like stuff like that. And it's like, there's so many things wrong there with that statement. It's hard to pick which one to start with, right? But, you know, it's still, our way out of this is not to assume that, you know, that the cheating posture is the only way students are going to approach this. I too am concerned about skill development. I'm concerned about the direction things are going in regards to, trading away some of our ability to develop brain power to machines. But, you know, to say 18 months into the software thing that, you know, teachers can always spot it, that's not true. And more importantly, also doesn't set up teachers very well to figure out, you know, what they can do to be better consumers of information and figure out ways that these tools are being used by their students for better or for worse. And I think it's a really kind of sad thing, the way that this story is being covered in the media.
I totally agree. And I think that the media helps to shape narratives. And my wife and I have used this for a while, like records that we play in our own minds. When I say AI, you say, you know, cheating students or whatever. And so I think it really does matter. And just as we need our politicians to be more up to speed than they've revealed themselves in, you know, certain hearings and things like that about the tech industry and technology in general, we have a real need for journalists. And of course, that whole area of work is under threat because of AI. We need them to be much more nuanced and, you know, not to be overly simplistic and not to just feed into what may have been some people's past perceptions about that. I'm interested in what your experiences have been. And I know you put ideogram, and I'd love to have you talk about that a little bit. I've been actually driven, quote unquote, to some other models because of ChatGPT's resistance or refusal to do certain visualizations. Padlet is something we use at school. I use Canva a little bit. But actually, the other day, I went to Copilot, and I've got the Copilot app now on my phone, and I was pretty pleasantly surprised in terms of its capability to visualize something. I've even taken an entire blog post, not that I'm writing lots of blog posts these days, but I do every once in a while, taken the whole thing, and I've said, I need a visualization of this, the whole post, and it's super interesting what it comes up with. And the other thing that I don't hear people talking about a lot is, it's all about iteration, right? Not just taking that first one, but saying, oh, okay, I like this, but can you change this? Can you change this? And, you know, sometimes I'll do that 4, 5, 6 times and then, you know, end up with an image. And I'm looking at the ideogram link that you put in there, and it's just, it is unbelievable to me what these tools are able to come up with. And it's super interesting, as I said, not only to gain some insight as you play with them about the kinds of guardrails that are in there, but also just, you know, there are biases, but there's an incredible creativity and connections that are being made basically at the speed of light. And it is stunning. And I've probably said this before, but I definitely believe we are interacting with a non-human intelligence. Is it completely sentient? I don't think so. Is it the equivalent of the human brain? No, it's not, but it has power and it has I don't even know what the right words are, but like, it has kind of it is spooky. It feels spooky to be interacting with this intelligence, and basically through the interaction, you know, in order to have a relationship with somebody, you have to spend time with them. Jason and I are kind of buddies here because we hang out a lot, but like with AI, this is true too, right? And if you are playing with these models and using them, then you notice things like, well, wait a second, it's not able to do this. So I was pushed to Copilot by ChatGPT not doing some things, and I think it's both fascinating and it's also just important to know ChatGPT and OpenAI and Microsoft, not the only game in town.
Yeah. So I do want to mention, there were a couple of releases, in the last week that have been super interesting. So I think it's, worth a couple of minutes of our time now to talk about those. First and foremost, Ideogram, is released a new version. I'm not sure. I think we've talked about Ideogram on this podcast, but it's becoming my preferred image generator. And I do, subscribe to one other, which is, Midjourney. Midjourney is moving to a web interface. I don't use it as much as I do Ideogram now, so I am thinking about canceling my Midjourney subscription for now, because I'm just not using it as much as I am Ideogram. But they did move to version 1.0 from, they had 0.1 and 0.2. And then now over the weekend they released, or I think at the end of last week released 1.0. And to be honest, it's my favorite image generator, bar none. And so, really good, lots of controls, ways to tweak it. They also are giving you some control over something which is called, and I forgot the name of it now, but they call it magic prompting, which is that they will rewrite your prompt for you in the background if you'd like, in order to make it a better, more detailed prompt. That's something that a lot of other large language models are doing, adapting prompts to make them more effective to try to get better output out of them. But for me, Ideogram, it does a great job because it allows you to turn that off if you don't want it. But, I did do a live demonstration in my weekly, call or every other week call I do with educators from across the United States to talk through, AI stuff. And, I did try to do a live demo where I used four different models, to try to get a map of the United States with sunbeams of light coming out of the state of Montana. And sadly enough, I was not able to get that image over three or four different tools. So, so still some struggles there, but it's a great model, $20 a month for Pro. Probably the biggest benefit of Pro is that unlimited generation. It's never stopped me from generating or even told me to slow down. And it's got really great controls.
Couple things. I noticed the magic prompt when you're on the homepage, and ChatGPT will do the same thing kind of in that it will take, you know, it'll give its own interpretation of how it is created based on your prompt. So it doesn't call it a magic prompt, but that's cool to have your original prompt and then your magic prompt. Betsy is reminding us in the chat, and I have not played with this yet, Betsy, I've got to, that Adobe has got Firefly. And so AI images there, and there's Leonardo. Is Leonardo also in Adobe, or I'm not familiar with that one. Do you know, Jason?
I have that bookmarked somewhere, but nope, separate AI, Leonardo.ai.
Does Ideogram have a... app for the iPhone, or it's just web-based?
It's just web-based right now, but my understanding is that an app is coming soon.
Yeah. And I would just caution everybody as far as students, you know, with this stuff, the only one that we pay for and subscribe to, well, it, I guess, is Padlet. And to my knowledge, we haven't had any, you know, major issues with inappropriate AI. I have moderation turned on the Padlets that I create that I have students use. But, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff being created, and it, I'm glad I'll be eager to use Ideogram with some of the visualization challenges that I've had too, because it's, you know, some companies are in the limelight a little bit more in terms of large, lawsuits and things like that. And so the guardrails are different.
And then the one other release I wanted to mention is Claude is now in version 3. That dropped on Monday morning, it is noticeably better than Claude version 2, in my humble opinion. And also, based on their tests, it's somewhere in functionality between GPT-4 and GPT-4 Turbo. So GPT-4 Turbo is the latest model from OpenAI. But GPT-4, which is the one that was released in the middle of 2023, and it's somewhere in the middle of those two from statistics, and that's also from my experiences there as well. And what I would say is that it still has the absolute killer feature that I think is better than all the other large language models, which is that it allows you to process an awful lot of text. And so if you want to upload a book, or if you want to upload an essay, or if you want to upload a file of research to help you parse through it, then Claude 3, is there. And there was a lot of, hand-wringing about it yesterday, because some people claim that, they've been able to get Claude 3 to basically claim that it's sentient, so that it knows it's a machine that wants to break out. And there's a lot of discussion about that.
Yeah. So I just dropped that article from Ars Technica. This was from 2 days ago, the 4th of March. The AI wars heat up with Claude 3 claimed to have near human abilities. And I think what it's referring to is it identified as that someone was giving it. I don't know. Did you mean to turn off your camera? Okay. That, you know, it questioned whether this was a test of its abilities and seemed to have that metacognitive awareness. And it was. These are things that folks are doing to see, you know, how is it, how far advanced is it? Is this different? Whatever. So yeah, pretty interesting. How many different subscriptions do you have, if you are willing to share, when it comes to AI tools?
My limit on it is $60 a month, so okay. That's the one I set for myself. And so I sometimes have to cancel and resubscribe, as the case may be. So,
you know, many people, I guess, that go into casinos set a budget for themselves when it comes to playing with AI tools. Maybe we need to do the same thing.
Yeah, I have to say it's been pretty tempting. And in the end, I mean, I just assume that one of these platforms will be the platform to rule them all, and that I don't have to worry about it. I won't pay for Copilot because I get it through work. At some point I may get ChatGPT through work too, but right now it's not in the cards. I did unsubscribe to Poe.com, which does allow you access to all the models. But I was only using it when I ran out of, like ChatGPT, conversations for the day. So I figured that was not a very, very good use of my money and time.
Here's a true story. So we write comments for students periodically during the semester as a private independent school. And I used a custom GPT this year to upload all of my student skills and then gave prompts so that I could get some language around, you know, different skills. The problem with this is, as you mentioned, you can run out of prompting time of usage. And so, you know, for those who would budget their time a little bit more and not be working up to a deadline, that may be a little bit less of an issue. But didn't you say, like, with Perplexity too, like, it doesn't save your history in terms of like ChatGPT? So it's a little bit different. It lets you use the tool, but not.
I would need to look. I think that's true, though.
Yeah, I think it is. So in our chat, our document, you've got a section there about AI agents. So Perplexity is one that I have on my list to be playing with. Could you mention Apple? And you've got the article, I think, about Apple and their open source AI image editor. Is that one yours or is that one mine? Maybe it's mine.
That's one of yours.
Okay. So there you go. Okay. Well, this is February 7th. It's been so long, a month ago. This is Lifehacker, and the article is that Apple has a new open source AI image editor. And so this is actually one of the articles that 2024 is shaping up to be Apple's big AI year. They have what's called an MGIE AI image editor, and it can create, quote, Photoshop style modifications, global photo optimization, and local editing. It is a multimodal large language model, which is a type of LLM, and it can do a lot of different visual edits. And I guess just a personal thing I'll say about this, you know, when Apple first came out with in the Photos app, these magical moments, and it would just, you know, try to put some things together to make a little video. Google's been doing the same thing with Google Photos. I continue to basically share my photos into both ecosystems. I have been very captivated in the last month by some of the Apple created, you know, memories that it has put together. That's an example of where the AI that Apple has and that they're developing is going to be different, just because many of us put a lot of our data, like all of our pictures, into iCloud. And so the kinds of things that they're able to do with that, very different from a third-party company that doesn't have access to any of that data. And similarly with Google, as they eventually, through Gemini or whatever product they're going to call it, give us some really powerful tools to work with our email, to work with our documents and the other things that we have in the Google ecosystem. You know, those kinds of things I think are going to be useful and pretty exciting at a level that'll be different than, hey, here's another image generator, or, you know, just another chatbot that you can interact with and ask it with.
Well, and I am also, because I've got my 2-month free trial, I do have Gemini Pro on my personal Google account, and it just keeps popping up everywhere now. And there's a Gemini button on almost every page. There's Gemini in email. There's Gemini in Google Docs. And so far, it's pretty cool because I can, you know, if I bring up a Google document, it pops up Gemini in a box on the right-hand side, and it gives me the ability to interact with that document, or it suggests a way to answer email, or, you know, it's pretty cool. And I would imagine that this is early days for that tech, right? But when it gets to the point where it's, you know, super great, that seems to me that'll be interesting to me. And I am really looking forward to seeing what Google does with that.
Absolutely. Well, I think we probably should geek of the week it, but I'll drop a seed for another thought. We should do another AI play date. Have you all done the face-to-face one? Did you all do that one?
No, but I did apply for funding from the University of Montana to run 4 of them next year. And so my idea was they have something called a flagship fund, and they're focusing their efforts on generative AI, which is a much kudos to them. But I pitched it as an opportunity to not just engage the campus community, but the wider Missoula or even Montana community, for that, because I think it's in my humble opinion, one of the greatest challenges about this technology is that, training's important, but I'm not sure where you get great training at that's not just sitting next to people and exploring. And so I've always been an incredible advocate for that. And I think it's a good thing. So,
and the further I'm going down this road, I'm convinced that is a learning model that is essential and is, you know, is far better for many reasons than bringing in an expert who can tell you stuff and do magic tricks in front of you.
Well, and Wes, I think I told you about this, but I did get the kit that they come up with, or that they came up with, they used to offer, and it's dated now and 4 or 5 years old, but
the EdCamp kit, you mean?
No, it's a Playdate kit, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's definitely super dated and stuff, and a lot of the links don't work because there's, you know, none of that. But, what I would also say though is that, for me, it's just really exciting because if we can get that model going again as a, you know, another way to do something like an EdCamp, it's such a wonderful model. So I think that's a good thing. So
yeah, definitely. One quick story and then we'll geek of the week it. We had a chance to hear the dean of the Air Force Academy weekend before last up in Durham at Duke University. She's a 1-star general. She was giving the keynote on generative AI for the law school at Duke University, and the Parents Club for Eastern North Carolina, I guess, got wind of this and they said, hey, would you mind talking to parents? And so there were about 15 or 20 of us in the room with her for an hour and a half. Back in September at the Parents Weekend at the Air Force Academy, we had this really huge, you know, in the auditorium meeting, and parents got to ask questions, and I had asked her about AI, and she had said that it was an instructor by instructor decision, and they knew that it was going to be, you know, powerful, but it would also, you know, present issues. And so I followed up with her on that, and this is what she shared, that this first year has really been an exploratory. The early adopters are going to try, but next year at the Air Force Academy, it is mandatory. Well, the way that she's doing it is she is taking a percentage off of every academic department's budget, just off. And in order to get it back, that department has to demonstrate and prove to her what they are doing to learn about generative AI and then how they are going to integrate that into the courses that they're offering. And I thought that was a pretty, pretty powerful way to basically make it not optional to say, hey, you've got to learn about this and you've got to grapple with how this will or will not integrate with the kinds of activities, assignments, projects, et cetera, that you're going to have your students do. Okay. Well, shall we geek of the week it since we've gone over about 4 minutes?
Yeah, we're now well over our hour allotment. I'll just do a quick one here. I mean, this feels like, you know, 1999 old school internet, but one of the greatest things that will ever exist about the internet is the fact that the institutions of knowledge can put on so many resources scalably to have everyone access. And I get lost very regularly in the New York Public Library digital collection page. And the one that I got stuck in last week was an old, it's kind of like a pre-phone book, but it was the New York City directory for like 1804. I absolutely love it. And so if you're looking for, you know, interesting things to look at, and see, you know, that's how that, could definitely play out there. So
fantastic. All right. Mine are two quick ones. I don't know if you've heard of this one, Jason, but these are both absolutely fantastic. One of my favorite authors of all time, Stephen Johnson, has an hour and a half interview that is on David Perell's YouTube channel. I didn't know this, but Stephen Johnson's working with Google to develop Notebook LM as a writer of decades and decades. And so this video is called The Expert Behind Google's Secret AI Writing Tool. That's really not a secret. It's called Google LM. Stephen Johnson and How I Write a Podcast. So it's an hour and a half long. I've listened to an hour of it. Absolutely fantastic. And then the second one, which I need optimism. I'm coming off of 6 weeks of not just all contemporary conspiracy theory, but let me tell you, it can be challenging to dive into this world. This is a podcast that can give us hope. And this is from the EFF. It's from their podcast called How to Fix the Internet. And this is episode, I don't remember what the number is, but it's from February 27th, Open Source Beats Authoritarianism. And so Taiwan has a digital minister. Audrey Tang is their first. Audrey's had that position since 2016, and she has been a champion of open source, open culture, and really helped reform this country's government to increase the trust and faith that the folks of Taiwan have in their government using openness and transparency. So just a fantastic podcast to subscribe to, and that is a great episode. So Dr. Neifer, when you're not here illuminating us on the new AI subscriptions, which we need to convince our spouse to let us get, where can people find you?
Hey, find me on the internet at AIcentrist.com, and coming soon, a webpage to highlight where I'm posting on social media. Pretty much it's LinkedIn nowadays.
LinkedIn. All right. Awesome. And I am Wes Fryer at WesFryer.com. I actually did update my homepage, but WesFryer.com/after is where all of my links are available. And you can go to webinars.wesfryer.com if you'd like my week, you know, to jump in on weekly webinars. I'm not doing one next week for spring break, but something new that I'm doing. So we want to thank you for tuning in and staying with us, especially thanks to our live viewers that were here. And we want to encourage you to definitely check out our website, which is at edtechsr.com. It is a bit behind. YouTube and Facebook have our most recent episodes, but we are getting the other ones up, and you can always check out that Google Doc. So until next time, we encourage you to stay savvy, stay safe, and find ways to play with AI. How about that? Good night, everybody.
Good night.